Excited to welcome former Bob Jones University head coach and current director of athletics at West Florida's Baptist Academy, Burton Uraro, to the Basketball Podcast. Uraro became head coach at Bob Jones University in 2017 as the second head coach in program history. In his first year as head coach, he led the Bruins to an astounding 22-11 record to lead them to their second NCAA D2 national tournament and the first NCAA D2 national championship game in program history. In his 8 seasons with the Bruins, Uraro led the team to 5 winning seasons and 4 regional championship titles. Each regional title was paired with a South Region Coach of the Year honor. Following the 2023-24 season, he was named the NCAA Division II National Coach of the Year, the only Bruin basketball coach to ever receive that honor.
Hey, Coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com. contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Burton, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's an honor to be with you. I've been a Chris Oliver Basketball Immersion follower since almost day one. I don't remember when I joined and got a membership, but it was pretty early on. So it's been great to watch you grow and your organization grow.
Thank you so much. Honored to be connected and grateful to follow your journey along the way as well. And we're on to a different phase in your coaching journey as well, moving from head coach at Bob Jones University. Talk to us about that transition.
Yeah, I'm an athletic director here in Florida. Coached for about 30 years at really every level. I don't think I skipped a level, starting as a middle school coach, going all the way up to coaching in college, coaching college for 8 years. And a while ago, I was in a bad car accident. I got hit by a semi, and so I spent part of my coaching journey in a wheelchair. Then I moved to a walker, then to a cane, and then I got better. And then coaching there in college, I had another accident, and I was just never really able to recover and get back to full health. And so I thought for my players, it was important to step down and move on to something new. And going through physical therapy now and doing all of that, but no one forced me out. No one even hinted that I should. In fact, a lot of people made accommodations for me to be able to stay and just do what I could do physically. But I couldn't look at myself in the mirror, and I just didn't feel like it was the right thing for me to continue to do something halfway. And a lot of people know who Tony Miller is, my assistant, and we've been friends for a really long time. And Tony was very capable. Tony had to coach some games, but at the last minute, just finding out that he needed to coach without a whole lot of preparation. And so him taking over as head coach this year was really not the first time he's had to do that. He had a little bit of training wheels, so to speak. So moved down here to Florida, had a lot of connections from my time, both as a high school coach and a college coach. I recruited this area, competed in this area. So I've still been able to go to some college and high school practices and really tap into a network that I've built along the years.
A great network. So many people I know, many people in common, Tony being one of them, as obviously a great sharer as well as you for the game. And we're happy the progress is going in the right direction. And also great to hear the support you got for coaches. And people don't think enough about some of the support coaches need. And I'm sure we'll get into that in different ways. But just selfishly, awesome to have you on in the middle of a season to be able to talk basketball and add value to coaches as well. So that's another thing that's certainly to our benefit. And let's think about that a little bit. People get asked me all the time what I miss about coaching. What are you missing right now about coaching?
What everybody says, I think, if they're in it for the right reason, is the relationships. I definitely don't miss the small college travel and the year-round recruiting camps, all the other things that go along with it. I don't miss those things, but there's the relationships. I've coached from as far north as Washington, D.C. to down here in Florida. And so I know a lot of people in the Southeast and went to college in Wisconsin, lived in California for a while. So there's a lot of people that I know. And I was starting to do some mentorship while I was there as a college coach. And so I've been able to continue to do that and grow that a little bit. I have a group chat with a lot of coaches in it, but I think I have, I don't remember the number, but I know I have almost 30 people who've either been a player or assistant or a manager for me that are head coaches right now. And so that's been a rewarding facet of this aspect of my life.
That's awesome. Great to hear you. And you've always been someone that wants to give back to the game, and you've done it in so many different ways. So awesome to hear that. And let's cover this first. One of the reasons we connected was I shared a video on the 1-3-1 deep inbound defense. And we're going to go a lot of places with this, special situations especially. But let's talk about that a little bit, the value of that, and then some of the things that you've learned from having used that.
I'll get to that specifically deep. I just think when you're talking about special situations, that's something that a lot of people start focusing on maybe a little bit later in their career. It's not the sexy thing to have an out-of-bounds defense when you're getting your first head coaching job. And I don't see a whole lot of people tweeting or posting about that on YouTube. In fact, it's really hard to find. I did a search just to see what came up, and there was the masterclass that you had done and then very little else. And I was mentored by Morgan Wooten, and it really surprises me how many people don't even know who he is anymore. But I had used his Coaching Basketball Successfully book in a college basketball class I took. And then I ended up moving to DC, working his camps, going to his practices. And one thing he did every practice was special situations, and he really drilled into me the importance of doing that. And if you don't mind, I'll talk about a couple of different ways that I've made that important. Is that good with you?
Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Starting really just from the warmups, I think we all do dynamic warmups, all that other kind of stuff, whatever you do. But sometimes, especially later in the season, I called it St. Mary's. I knew a coach at St. Mary's College in Maryland, and we talked about this, and he gave me the idea of this, but we had a play for 7 seconds, 5 seconds, 3 seconds, 1 second. And so five would run 7 seconds down with the clock going, then they would wait down there, and then the next five would run the same 7 second play. You come back with the five, go down with a three, and then come back with a one. And as you're getting closer to the end of your season, you know, a lot of people put special situations at the end of practice. They don't get to it. They intend to, but somebody made them mad and they feel like they've got to do something else. And so I felt like doing that from the get-go in practice set a tone. It made me make sure that I didn't skip it. There were just a lot of things, even with a dynamic warm-up, that just set the tone that this is something that's really important. And we all know that players are the most focused when they're fresh. The second thing that I would do a lot was a special situation tournament, especially earlier in the year. I can share that with you later if you want, but I've broke down like basically four different tournaments that we would have. And so I would use the tournaments to teach early in the year. We would stop, give them a chance to ask questions. Tony would coach one team. I would coach the other. Sometimes I would have two of the younger guys that were maybe grad students. I would have them coach, and Tony and I would sit there and talk. I would intentionally have a player manager, ref, so that they got used to dealing with the referees. But when we would start talking about what we wanted to do and all of that, and really it was not an X's and O talk, it was a philosophy talk. And so that went from timeout organization, where I sat positions 5-4-3-2-1. Their subs stood behind them, so everybody was facing me. We weren't having the crowd interfere from behind the bench, all of that sort of thing. I think timeout organization is a part of special situations that just most coaches don't even think about. But I would teach them the questions to ask for that. And then we would go into the old, by the time we were starting conference play, we weren't doing so much of the special situations tournament, but we would be doing the 76-76. As soon as one team gets to 80, the clock starts counting down from 3 minutes, and we would give them who has fouls, all that kind of stuff. But we would do that every day, and sometimes multiple times in a day. And with approaching special situations from a teaching aspect early, but not really 5-on-0, really getting them into those situations in a tournament, and then going 70, 70, 76, 76 all the time. We really took pride in that. It's something that we marked up in our team room where everybody knew how we did with that. It was a highlight of our film. And I think if you're going to say something's important, people don't believe what you say, they believe what you do. And if all of your actions show that special situations is important, then it becomes important to them. If you say it's important, then, and you don't ever spend much time on it, or there's no consequences for not doing it right, then I don't think it's going to be important to them. And we had 2 years ago, when we had the best record in school history, we had 5 games come down to the last play. And it wasn't what they ran, it was knowing what we wanted them to do. It was having the habits built in where we won every single one of those games. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Would you like me to get into deep just a little bit?
Let's first go back. Let's support what you're saying a little bit, is that it's a very common thing to neglect special situations or do it at the end of practice. So I love that idea of doing it at the beginning, doing it as part of your dynamic warm-up, so to speak, and just getting them mentally there. But the other part that you hit home that I want coaches to connect with is the idea that, look, you're not just doing these because you're actually going to run these plays. You're doing that because it builds this self-belief in players, in themselves, that they understand the situation, they can handle the situation, and obviously in you and a coach when they need that. And that self-belief is such a superpower.
One of the key special situations that people don't think of is the tip-off play, or how you... we would script like the first 3 actions that we would run. And so sometimes we would, they would do the dynamic just like we would in a game where they're not really doing it on the court. They're doing it out in the hallway or in an auxiliary gym. And then as soon as we walked into the gym, we would do the jump ball to give them, to put them in the mindset of, this is what we're going to do right from the beginning. And we would, if you go through, especially if you have 2 or 3 days of preparation and you've done that a couple of times and it's a conference game, so many conference games come down to 5 points or less. And if you can, let's say your defense is one of your superpowers, if you can score, get right into your defense and then do that a couple of times, our whole idea was getting kills, 3 stops in a row, and we're scoring in that. And if you do that 7 to 9 times a game, you're almost always going to win. And so why not just do that from the very beginning of the game?
I love that. And you mentioned a few of the ones that might be neglected. What in your mind are some other special situations that are neglected?
Last play of the first half. I see, we don't like to sometimes acknowledge momentum, but I see so many, especially defensive errors at the end of the first half. Maybe it's a key player gets that third foul that if they just did one more disciplined thing, they wouldn't get that. I used to try to target those guys as when we had the ball at the end of the half. And so I know that's a thing that coaches should be thinking about. And then really the first play of the second half, you go in, you make some smart adjustments, and if you know you're going to be on defense, then go ahead and throw something out there that they haven't seen. On offense, maybe try to get that person in foul trouble that you didn't get at the end of the first half. Maybe try to get them in foul trouble in the second half by Iverson play, where you can get everybody up and out of the way and you can just drive right at that person, whatever the case may be.
Love it. And one of the reasons we came to deep, and we can talk about it now if you want, or anything like that, yeah, is this concept that I do, like, this is one of the things when I mentor coaches, is how many coaches I find that don't spend as much time as I think necessary on stopping special situations, on defending special situations. And that's one of the advantages of playing, like you said, a lot of these special situation tournaments. It's not just offense. It's like how you're defending them. What are the situations? And I feel it starts with Bob defense, inbound defense. I felt if we ever got scored on inbound defense, that was my bad as a coach, because we didn't prepare and we didn't get ready to be able to take away, because we can always take away a first option, a second option, I feel.
And if you think about it, a lot of teams don't like playing against a 1-3-1, which is the basic deep alignment. They don't like facing a half-court offense that's 1-3-1 for the type of passes that they have to make. And in 1-3-1 coming down the court, the point guard can move and get a better passing angle. And when you're the baseline defender, you can't go to the weak side because of the backboard being there. You can't throw the loop pass. You can only throw a really low pass. And so your options are limited as an inbounder. You basically have about 75% of the court that you can work with, and that 25% away from you is really difficult. And so I try to instill that in my players' minds to give them confidence. Okay, this guy's stationary. We're not. And so we know the options that he has. So let's defend the 75% of the court really well. There's going to be times where different things happen. Maybe a player that's got a specific position in the deep alignment, maybe he's doing a secondary job and he's not as great at that. There's going to be things that happen, but I would bet that you're still not going to get scored on. Somebody maybe got it where they were supposed to. Maybe they score in a secondary action, but they're not going to score right off of the inbounds play. And so that's really the first thing that I inject. And then I inject, you've got one person out of bounds, they've got four in. And so in a way, you're basically playing 5-on-4 for a little bit. And I try to put my offense into the situation and say, this really starts getting to that guy that's got an inbounds. He really starts panicking. And it doesn't matter how good the ref is at signaling. That is very difficult. You start panicking really after about 3 seconds. And so if you take away their hot options, their most obvious options in the first 3 seconds, you're probably going to force a bad pass eventually.
So, and I want coaches to know, like, I never ran deep, but studying deep helped my man-to-man inbound defense, because right, exactly what you said. One of the first things was, where are you trying to not let the ball go with the inbound passer, or where are you trying to influence the ball to go? And as you said already, what it does a great job of, or what good inbound defense does, is basically you have to try and score off of secondary options, because we're not giving up that pick the picker. And coach, I still see so many teams get scored on pick the picker on the weak side. And that was, again, fundamentally, that was one of those things. Are they trying to attack the rim, or are they trying to attack out? And that was the determining factor in our inbound defense. Which did they try and attack first? We were trying to take that away.
So I had watched this type of defense a long time ago when Bruce Pearl was at Tennessee. I think it was Kevin Stallings was at Vanderbilt, and both of them ran it. But I didn't really understand what I was seeing at that point in my career as far as understanding it well enough to teach it. And then T.Y. Young, who's an assistant now at Miami, he's been at Missouri, Florida State. He was a head coach at Georgia Southern when I was in Georgia. And he was at a clinic that I was at and talked to him a lot. And he taught it really well. And he will tell you, he has been hired to the places he's been hired basically for how he teaches this defense and what it does for the program. He's an awesome recruiter. In my opinion, he's the best recruiter in college basketball. But secondarily, he is really good at teaching this defense. And so obviously different personnel require a different focus. I was awesome at it when I had a 7-footer guarding the inbounder. I was not as awesome at it when I had a 6'5 guy guarding the inbounds. And we all know how that goes. I didn't start forgetting anything. I didn't become a worse coach. There's just more options available when you have a shorter guy doing that, but you can crowd and make it look like a 3-2. Alabama Huntsville ran it a few years ago after Acuff left to go to Lipscomb. I forget who the coach was that put it in, but it looked more like a 3-2. And then they would get right into a zone. We did. I know you've had Greg Neely on and you've talked about his zone, and Greg's a good friend of mine and Tony's, and we ran the same zone. And so it fit with our zone principles, but you don't have to be a zone coach to run it. But because it fit with our zone principles, the name of it, deep, is really you're trying to get them to throw a deep pass. Everything on the strong side, ball side of the court, should look like it's a threat. If you get it there, okay, you may be able to actually get the pass in. But if you get it in, we're going to trap you in the coffin corner. You're not going to be able to get it in the middle. And so many people try to throw it in the past half court and get it really deep, and they feel like that's a win. To me, that's a win, especially in low clock situations. I know it's something that coaches specifically have to prepare for, because coaches are now being really honest with me that I competed against because they don't have anything at stake anymore. When I've asked them, what was it like preparing for us? What were our weaknesses, strengths? Almost everybody has said, we hated going against that stinking defense. We would start working on it a couple of weeks before we played you because it was such a pain in the butt to face.
It's always such a great compliment when that happened. And I love that.
If I can take away the other coach's practice time, I feel like I did something. And that's another thing that Morgan Wooten used to say. It's really, you're eating into their practice time and don't let them eat into yours. And so I think preseason preparation, knowing your team, knowing your opponents, which you've got a good opportunity to do in the preseason and the off season, I think that's a big part of it. Making your practices more effective is really knowing what is going to be difficult for the other teams to prepare for.
Love that.
Do you know which lineups and player combinations are the most productive? Hoopsalytics has the most comprehensive lineup analysis system available. Coaches can see how each group performs offensively or defensively or excels in special situations. For example, if you need to force a late game turnover, you can see which group has the best defensive turnover percentage, or see which four athletes work best with your star player. And you can do the same team-based analysis for groups of two or three players as well. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com today to learn more.
And let's dive through a bunch of things. We talked about the importance of special situations. Talk to us about one-on-one meetings. I know that's something that's been important for your coaching.
Yeah, if you don't mind, there's four phases that I've talked about that a coach goes through. The beginning phase, they've got a lot of passion and excitement and enthusiasm, but they don't know what they don't know. In the development phase, the second phase, they know what they don't know, but then they start to focus maybe on X's and O's, and they don't really realize their limitations too much. This should be the time when you're reading books, going to clinics, working camps, all that other type of stuff. Then there's a master coach, competent in most areas, but maybe an expert in two areas. And because of success, though, the danger is that they can start to become complacent. And then the mentor coach is where I feel like I'm at right now and where I've been at for the past few years, where you're looking to what you can pass on to the next generation. Legacy is really important to you, and relationships are more important than wins and losses. That's been my philosophy for a while as far as what's been written down. I don't know that it's been applied until maybe since after COVID. COVID really was a reset for a lot of people. I refocused on a lot of things, and I started doing a lot of evaluation. And since mentorship is important to me, I decided that one-on-one meetings are important. I don't think it's mentorship happens necessarily in a group setting. And I worked with Tony. We divided the team up between the assistant coaches, and each one of us would meet with, if we had a team of 12 and we've got three coaches, we would meet with four guys a week, and we would rotate throughout the year who had the four. And our kind of our driving force was, we're not allowed to talk about basketball unless the player brings it up. We talk about what's going on in their life, what they're learning, what they're struggling with. And Chris, I found out guys who were contemplating suicide. I found out abuse situations going on in the home. I found out a lot of things that maybe I wish I didn't know. But when you understand those things, you can coach them better. We may label them as having a bad attitude, but what we don't know is maybe they haven't eaten in the past three meals and they're really hungry at practice. That's why they have no energy. And I'm really thankful that the idea kind of came to me to do that. But I track it on Google Sheets, and I'm willing to share anything that I talk about here. But just a simple tab for each player, because we're not going to remember things in our head. And so keeping a tab on that in Google Sheets, being able to set a reminder to follow back up with a person maybe that you had that person in your first group and you want to reconnect with them when they're not in your group a little bit later on. I think anything you can do to make things systematic and organized helps you during the still do everything you want to do in your program, because as the season goes on, especially in January and February, this can be a thing that goes off to the side. But mental health people will tell you that January and February are also some of the toughest months of the year for people. And if it's the toughest part of the season, toughest part of the year for most people because of weather or whatever, that should be the time where you're connecting with them the most. That should not get pushed to the side, in my opinion. And it doesn't have to be very long, but it can be 5 to 10 minutes. You can just, if you do have 4 days a week and you're playing games, two of those other days, you can just touch base before or after practice with a guy. But obviously going to lunch, getting away from everything, whatever the case may be. I think if people come to your office and they're sitting across from you on a desk, that's just a confrontational environment. And I think the simple act of having a player sit in the passenger seat of my car where we're looking together in the same direction, I know that sounds cheesy, but some of my most effective conversations have happened in a car driving around, like Jerry Seinfeld and his comedians in cars having coffee. I'd have that idea, but I don't have the salary that Jerry Seinfeld ended up with.
Not yet, coach.
Not yet.
It's coming. I love this. I love that perspective. It's a common topic, but I love the way that you present it, the way that you think about it. It's great to be able to talk about it in that sense, especially the importance of it during certain times of the year more than even other times. And you're right. We get so busy during a season that sometimes we neglect these things. And a lot of these meetings aren't necessarily long either. And that's somewhere that's an intimidation for coaches. They don't have to be formal. They don't have to be long.
I read a book. I don't have it with me. But leading with questions. And I read that back when I was a principal, and that's really made an effect on me. I think you can really get a lot further with people if you just ask questions. It makes them feel like you're curious about them. You can have leading questions that kind of gets them to think the way that you're thinking, but they're coming up with it on your own. And that's a book that I think is really effective for anybody in leadership, just to learn how to formulate questions a little bit better. And that really helps you get to know, and it helps you be organized and not waste time. If you know what questions you're going to ask in advance, and you don't have to be typing in your Google Sheets while the player is sitting right in front of you. If you already know the questions you're going to ask, you can remember enough, I believe, to go back and fill that out later and not have your attention diverted while you're sitting there with the player, especially if you're in a car, like I mentioned, or you're out somewhere. It's a little bit more natural just to have a conversation that way and not be typing things up.
Building on that, discipline. Talk to us about discipline being the shortcut.
Yeah, discipline and mentorship. I came across a quote, "Your future is shaped by the habits you repeat, not the goals you set." And recording this on January 2nd, I don't think that resolutions are necessarily, that's not something I've ever looked at, but I have looked at this time as a time of evaluation. And we are great at having goals and ideas, and we are not so good at the follow through. And I think if we can shorten the distance between knowing and doing, we're ahead of our peers. I came across a stat a while ago. I think it was on a TED Talk. That's a 100-hour rule, where if you spend 18 minutes a day, you're in the top 5% of people in your discipline. 95% of the world doesn't do that. And so I was talking before in the mentor or in the master phase about being an expert at two things. I think a wise coach, maybe through asking other people, having other head coaches evaluate them, developing a relationship with the coaching mentor, they can figure out what they need to be good at. And then I think our personalities lead us into what we want to become an expert at. But I think if you spend 18 minutes a day, which all of us can do, even during the season, about being better at some aspect of leadership, culture, or basketball, I think that discipline, and then along with that, having a mentor and learning from that mentor and getting either accurate feedback or advice given to you where there's no advantage for them in giving you that advice. I think that can be a real shortcut that I haven't done many things right in my life, but I've done a good job of developing mentors. I bugged Doug Novak for years, and in bugging Doug, Doug introduced me to Coach Tower at St. Thomas. And Morgan Wooten has passed away, but his son Joe and I are the same age, and Joe's an incredible coach. And working those camps and all of that, Tobin Anderson, Tobin and I were working the Wooten camp years ago, and then I started coaching Tobin's son at camp. And you talk about, you can't plan those things in advance. Those guys weren't my mentors because of how famous they were or any awesome thing that they had done. They were people who were really good at things that I wanted to be good at. And having those guys as mentors and having the discipline to follow up with them has helped me for job recommendations. It's helped me be a better coach quicker, a lot of things. They think about things in a different way than I do. And that has been super valuable for me.
Love that. Love those connections, and a beautiful game when you get out there and you share. And do you think that's something that is a little bit different over the last 30 years, is just coaches, their interactions with each other, post-game, pre-game, tournaments, just less of those moments together. And now a lot of it is obviously online or texting or different things like that.
Yeah, I don't know what to do about it. I wish I did, but that is one thing that bothers me. And that is kind of one reason why I have a GroupMe text chain. Some coaches I've never even met in person, they just started following me on social media, and we've had a lot of communication. And if it has to be virtual, I think it's better virtual than not. But yeah, that's one thing that is really tough. Some of those camps still exist. Obviously, it's a lot different than when you and I were coming up through, but Wooten camp, I still try to get back there whenever I can. And it's a neat thing to come back in the summer away from everything and reconnect with everybody.
Love that part of coaching for sure. And a lot of fun to be able to do that. With everything that you've done, another kind of experience, and I think even relevant to being an athletic director now, is your relationship with parents. So talk to us about your approach. You've coached high school, you've coached college, now you're an athletic director again. Talk to us about the relationship with parents.
I could do probably a 3 podcast session on parents, but we love to talk at the preseason parent meeting about all the love we have in our program, man. We are just all about love, and we are all about having a great culture, but that culture tends to be, and that love tends to be between the coach and the players, and the parents aren't included in that. And that's something that I've really noticed over the years. Almost everybody views parents as the enemy. And in my opinion, if you reframe it, I really think that a good basketball coach can help build the parent-child connection. I don't think that it's like sometimes just really get into evaluating how somebody is parenting their child as if we're experts on that. And it's not our job to help remedy a situation that you may see. Maybe the parent really is a bad parent. I think we have the opportunity to help in some situations, especially if we're meeting with all 3 parties at one time. So that would be the way that I start, is the parents are not the enemy. They are going to always be around. And so I think the smart coach is not try to complain about a situation that you don't like. I think a smart person in any situation, and I think any leader, tries to figure out how to leverage the situation to benefit everybody. And so I think that starts with reframing. And then I think another key thing is communication. What people are not up on, they're down on. And if you try to avoid the parent meeting or set up all these rules for what parents have to do and what they can and can't talk about, they're going to communicate with somebody. They're going to communicate with your boss, and they're going to communicate to all the other parents that are sitting in the stands. And right now, they're probably communicating to a coach at a rival school or U program about their kid transferring. And so if you want to seal your doom, just keep isolating parents that way. And so I think, again, if you reframe it, tell parents the kind of communication that you do want. And again, with asking questions, I would send out a parent questionnaire. I personally, I know this is tough, but I prided myself on doing things different than a lot of coaches. In the off season, in the spring and in the summer and a little bit in the fall, I would meet with parents in their home with their child. And when I was a high school coach, and that's tough to do, but I also went to 5 straight Final Fours and I won 3 championships in a row with different lineups, different ways, different defenses. I did it 3 different ways. And I would say the last time I did it, we had a losing record and we became 500 by winning the championship. And I feel like my relationship with the parents and their child and doing all of the hard work early has always made my seasons go by a lot easier. I know that's a lot. I could give you, like I said, I could give you 3 podcasts worth of it, but hopefully that's helpful.
It's very helpful. And you and I have had a lot of experience with parents at a lot of different levels.
I started getting passionate about it. I'm sorry if I started being a Southern Baptist.
Never apologize, coach, for a passion. Love that. And to your point, most parents are on your team. Most parents want to be on your team. So how can you get them on your team, and how can you keep them on your team is a big part of that. And you nailed it with communication and finding ways again to have some of those informal, not so intense conversations where you develop those relationships to make them an ally is such a big part of it. So love that idea about meeting them in their home.
I think if people have a preseason meeting and they do a group me text on Sunday night, they feel like that's communication. And technically it is, but I think I've done a newsletter and I'd be willing to share the newsletter before. I've had speakers come in that talk about how to be a healthy sports parent. I've tried to take all the venom away. And I think you have to be really clear in the preseason meeting, just be as blunt and open and honest as you can. And then after you've been that blunt, open and honest, I think the next key is being consistent with all the things you said you were doing, the ways that they earn playing time, the things that they can get in trouble for. Just be clear about all of that up front. And then the hardest thing is to be consistent about what you said was most important to you. And parents will call you out on any of those inconsistencies, which they have a right to. You can't say this is the set of criteria that they need to follow, and then you don't follow that yourself. You just erode all trust and credibility if you do that.
Absolutely. And you mentioned your program's reputation a little bit. Talk to us about building a reputation on toughness and grit.
Going back to maybe being expert or something, but I've won championships at levels, like I said, but at all different levels with doing vastly different things. But I think if you talk to people who've known me, they would say special situations, defense, and good team culture have always been a part of those programs. And so I think that you need to, trying to think of the best way to say this, new coaches want to be good at everything. And I think one thing mentorship can help you with is saying, this is enough for you to be good year one. This will keep you out of having a lot of problems. I'm working on the side right now. I'm trying to develop curriculum that way because I don't really see that kind of thing out there for coaches, but this will keep you out of trouble in year one. This is all you really need to be good at instead of trying to be good at everything. And then trying to stair step that. And I don't think you can really know what you want your program to be known for until you've been at it for a couple of years, but you do have to start somewhere. I do think it's important to have a philosophy and have it written down. Know why you coach. If you know why you coach, it helps guide your coaching decisions. It helps guide your personnel decisions. It helps all of that. And then I do think you need to evaluate your coaching philosophy every year. Mine is vastly different than what it was 30 years ago, but at least I have one. And I put it in a frame on my nightstand so I can look at it and be reminded on a daily basis why I'm doing what I'm doing. It keeps you from all the highs and lows and just helps keep you steady on the main thing, keeping the main thing.
Great insights.
And you mentioned already, Tony, but like being able to hire people in your program as well that can challenge you, can support you, can fill in areas, that's also important. And that's got to be a big part of the mentorship, is to be able to help people be secure enough or confident enough, or to help find those people as well. Because sometimes it's not easy to find people like that as well. And I know that both of us in our career have had great assistants. We've had people doing it for all the right reasons, but we haven't always had those people that do it in a way that challenges us in the right ways.
Yeah, I have been really blessed, and that some of my best assistants have been ones where we've had arguments, and the arguments are really, if you peel it back, you're really just passionate about stuff. I can't think of a time where it has ever been personal, and it does need to be private. No, I've got a guy right now. He was a film guy for the 76ers, and now he's on the G League team for the Nets. And so I've got guys go that level. I've got a couple of different guys in college. Tony and I knew each other for a long time. We used to work Duke's basketball camp, go to Duke's clinics, all that kind of stuff way before we were ever on the same staff. And Tony had been at Bob Jones since they started a program. He had been there for, I think, 8 years, really just as a player development guy, an individual workout type guy, and wasn't really even on the bench during games. And I knew what he had to offer. And I've always been a collaborative guy. I've never tried to make it about me. And sometimes that's just been about insecurity when I was younger and I didn't want all the responsibility. Then it grew into, I don't want it to be all about me. I want to share the responsibility. And so I went from being scared to making sure that I wasn't being arrogant, that I was just another guy on the bus. I wasn't the whole bus, so to speak. And I really think when I was in Georgia and I was relegated back to being in a wheelchair when I was a high school coach, I had not adequately prepared my assistants for the possibility, because I didn't know that I needed to. I didn't know that was ever going to come about. And so when I got a college job, my very first meeting with Tony, I said, you know, you're going to be in charge of the defense. I'm going to be in charge of the offense. And I tried to coach that way. I didn't do a great job of it the first year. And then we started flipping those roles. I think when you're in charge of defense, you get exposed to all the different offensive things that people can do. And I think that speeds up learning. But Tony's passion and expertise is really in the area of offense. And we flew up to Minneapolis, spent time with Doug. I flew in Mark Cassio to come spend time with us during COVID. I don't think a whole lot of college coaches would fly in. Mark was a high school coach of a small private school in Louisiana at the time, but he was good at what he did. I saw that. We had communicated a lot. And so I think even though Mark wasn't my assistant, I think that showed my assistant that you can always learn from everybody. And I've had some assistants go on to do other things. One of my coaches there in Atlanta, he was the first African-American male to get Teacher of the Year in Georgia. He's been on CNN and Kelly Clarkson and all these talk shows. And now he's a renowned speaker, has nothing to do with basketball, but he gives me credit. I don't know that I deserve it, but he does give me credit for giving him the confidence to do things and to pour into other people. And so I think having quality assistant coaches doesn't necessarily mean they're in basketball for the rest of their life, but maybe they have another way that they're influencing people and leading in their own special arena.
Great to hear about your journey. And one thing that we wanted to get to was this concept of what would I do differently, or what would I do more of or less of, et cetera. And I'm glad you shared this with me. I know it's a common question I get asked a lot. What would I do differently, coach? Let's start with try to stop and enjoy.
I don't know if most coaches would have heard of Gene Durden. Dean Durden was a high school coach in the Atlanta area, still is, but he started a thing, Breakfast Club. And when I was there in Atlanta, I started the same thing, having kids come in before school of any age, any gender, literally have breakfast for them, but just help them get in work. And so I started doing that. The problem was we would win a championship on a Saturday, and I would the next Monday be doing that. And I thought I was showing people how dedicated I was, how passionate I was. And I probably did show them that. But what I didn't show them, including my spouse, was I was not a person of balance. And so I think when you're coaching, the first assistant coach or the first team you're coaching is your own family and your own marriage. And my wife, she ran in college. She's always been a cross-country track coach. And so she understands that, but there are some things that she understood that maybe I shouldn't have made her understand. I can't say that I'm raising men and doing all this stuff and I've got this great culture and I'm passing on how to be a good husband and father, and I'm not doing the same thing. And so I think my balance was off, and I don't think that I know for a fact. I used to tell Tony, I've never enjoyed any of the championships. I didn't enjoy the process or anything. And the closest I came to enjoying it was being able to have a normal season a year or two after COVID and winning another conference championship. Then I enjoyed that season more than maybe any other season. But I would say that's the number one thing I would do differently is enjoy the process a little bit more and have a little bit more balance. I would say something else I would do differently is maybe having the power of courageous conversations. I think you should have a courageous conversation as a coach with somebody on your team. I'm not kidding. You probably need to have one daily with either someone on your coaching staff or a player, because we're all human. We veer off course, and the coach is the one, you know, that knows the way, shows the way, and goes the way. And if you don't correct something that you see that's eroding your culture, so that becomes the new norm, whatever you accept, whatever's going on with your team is either taught or allowed. And you're either teaching bad or good culture, or you're allowing bad or good culture. And so I think I was, as a lot of young coaches are, I was nervous to have those courageous conversations earlier on. And we just, when we're younger, we hope that things are going to get better. And you probably heard people say, hope is not a strategy. Having a definite conversation. And again, it doesn't have to be talking down to somebody. It can be just a question. Is that the way we really want to do things here? Is that us showing up as our best? And so that's one thing I would do differently. Being organized earlier would be another thing. Again, with the Google Docs, every tweet, Instagram post, YouTube clip, anything like that I come across that I think will really help us at some point, I put into Google Sheets. And in that, it's a total team document with tabs for what our budget is for the year. I've got that one locked, that tab locked. It's got my conversations in it. Those are also locked that only the coaching staff can see. Our hotel room set up, what we spent for food at this point last year, all of those different things. I think if you're just getting the habit of, you know, that with Google, you can do that right on your phone in practice if you need to, if something comes up to you. And so really, I think there's no need to be disorganized. There are too many easy things at our disposal where you can use that. And then the last thing, I know I've gone on a long time. The last thing I would say is be deeper read than widely read at this point in the year. I see people posting pictures of the 50 or 60 books that they read this year. And I'm not being critical. Maybe I'm the only dumb one, but I don't know how I think a book should affect you. I think a book should change you. And I don't think that you should bother reading it if you're not getting something from it, unless maybe it's some pleasure reading at the beach. But if you are reading to get better, it takes time to let that sink in. It takes time to evaluate. It takes time to keep your own notes in the book and all of that. And I think that you should do all of those things. I heard a podcast a long time ago where George Raveling was being interviewed on Tim Ferriss's podcast. And he talked about how he chose books and how he made notes in books and all of that. And that's one of the more powerful episodes I've ever seen. So again, you can reach out to me if you want any of those book recommendations, but there's about 12 to 15 books that I think every coach should read. And only when you've started to master those concepts do I think you should go on to something else.
Love great insights. And talk to us about coaching with anger or trying to coach without anger. Because I think, again, a lot of young coaches, that's one of the first places to try and get beyond yourself in.
Again, I don't love talking about myself, but I have had a pretty decent amount of success and I've never had a technical in 30 years of coaching. And I've just, and I think when you're coached by people who get technicals and who are coaching angry all the time, when you become a coach yourself, you don't want to be that. And so I think that probably affected me, but I still coached angry in practice. I still coach my players angry. So you can still be an angry coach and not be getting on the referees. I was having the mindset of everybody's out to screw me over, man. These refs woke up today and they could not wait to just ruin my day. They want me to get fired from this job. And when you're coaching angry all the time, that means you're coaching with emotion all the time. And when you're really emotional, I think scientists will tell you, you're not very rational. And your players are, again, they're going to, you can't tell us, say that we're going to be disciplined in special situations. We're going to spend all this time. We're going to be the most disciplined team in our conference and then not be disciplined yourself. You look at Coach Sig at Indiana, his players are not getting penalties. Indiana does not beat themselves. And I think that's a huge reason for their success. People make fun of his face, his body language, but Indiana football is doing something that's never been done in college sports. Because I think largely because they have a stoic coach who focuses on what he can control. That doesn't mean he's not angry, but the most you'll get from him is the raised eyebrow that he does, the kind of a scowl. And the coaches that I revere, Brad Stevens, he did that. I revere Jay Wright. The coaches who I've always tried to emulate were coaches that were not on the refs all the time. And if they were on their players, they were on them in a way that made them want to do better. I think my one-on-one meetings with my players have been my secret sauce. They want to please me, so to speak. And so their motivation is not wanting to let me down. Their motivation is not being afraid of making a mistake and knowing that I'm going to yell at them. And if I do ever yell, it is such a rarity that it tends to be super effective because it's so rare. They know that it's something that is super urgent, something that I'm really passionate about. And that for me, at this point in my life, will always be attitude or effort. It will never be about execution, especially in a game. And that can bleed over into your film session, and your film session can go on and on. You can get super sarcastic. And I think if you just focus on three video clips, and maybe you go over that a couple of times and the session takes a little bit longer. But I think in this day and age, that helps you keep from even doing film sessions and sarcasm, just limiting yourself to the clips that you're going to show, already knowing in your mind what you're going to say when you stop it. Again, asking really good questions instead of you telling them and talking to them. I think it's much more informative if you're asking questions. I know that I went on to the next thing from coaching and anger, but I think my film sessions are where I still showed a lot of anger and it showed up as sarcasm. And I think a way that I got rid of that is just by having three things and asking questions. And that helped me not coach with anger in my film sessions.
The insight, one thing to say it versus the other thing to do it. And you gave us insights in terms of how to do it and how to handle it and how to change it. And also some common sense kind of things about why you would reflect on not being so angry when you coach. And easier said than done, clearly. But coach, so many things throughout the podcast and people can understand why, long overdue to give you a platform to be able to share some of these ideas on my podcast. And I'm grateful for that. Any closing thoughts for us as, again, you're going down the deep sharing hole for us?
I'll just think about maybe this time of year. I used to write on the top of my practice sheet, so just so I would think about it, is focus on the root, not on the fruit. And you can't focus on the root and be continuously adding at this point in the year. You should be paring down, simplifying, worried about your players, your rest, their legs, getting more into the culture aspect, the mental aspect, all of that type of stuff, but I would be focusing on the things that are causing turnovers. I would be focusing on a lot of free throw shooting, special situations, those type of things. At the end of the year, as we started nearing playoffs, I would bring back those special situation tournaments and do that, actually have a winner and a loser and really make that a big deal. And so that made our practices game-like, but it also made, in those tournaments, you're working on your press, you're working on your blob defense, you're working on your comeback game, you're working on every aspect, and you can tweak it a little bit, do one all zone, one all man, one where they don't know what's coming, all that type of stuff. But I think we think that more is better. And I think right now, especially at this point in the year, less is better. And don't worry so much about your opponent. That's a hard thing to do. Worry about you. Don't be talking about your opponent all the time. Don't be spending a long time on them knowing what the scout is. You can insert that yourself in the special situation tournament, but that would be my advice going forward at this point in the year.
I love it. Incredible advice. And we don't probably talk enough about, we talk about what to do getting ready for your season. Now what to do once you're in your season is probably something that could be discussed more. But Coach, we're so grateful for you and all the sharing. I'm grateful for our relationship. And thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
Again, like I started off with, Chris, I'm so thankful for you. There's relationships that I've made based on, you know, what I've heard on your podcast. There's guys that I've reached out to, and Malcolm Gladwell talks about people that are connectors, and I think you are the great connector of our game globally. I don't know who else but you connects. Maybe it's you and Silver in charge of the NBA. Maybe it's you two that connect the most people in basketball. So I appreciate you.
Thank you, Coach. Appreciate that.
All right. Thank you.